Chapter 29. The giant video screen in the conference room glowed blue for a second, then an image appeared. There was a flash of silvery white scales in a net, and Mike Neal was heard shouting, "Hold on, folks, we got a live one!" There was a blurred glimpse of a fish slamming against the deck and a close-up of a toothy mouth snapping a gaff handle in two. The handheld camera showed the same fish being clouted with a baseball bat. The astonished voices of the Trouts were audible in the background. Paul Trout clicked the remote control and froze the picture. The lights blinked back on, and a crisp, commanding voice was heard to say, "It seems Jaws has formidable competition." Admiral James Sandecker, the driving force behind Numa, sat at a long conference table, his head enveloped in a purple cloud that belched from the fat cigar in his hand. "That thing up on the screen is in a class of its own, Admiral," said Gamay, who sat at the table along with Austin, Zavala, and Rudy Gunn. "The great white shark attacks when it's hungry or hunted. The creature we're looking at is more like Mac the Knife. Just plain mean and hungry." Sandecker blew out a plume of smoke and glanced around the table. "Now that you've engaged my attention with what must be the shortest monster movie on record, please tell me what in blazes is going on and what that creature has to do with the cast on Paul's wrist." Gamay and Paul took turns telling the story of their Canadian adventure, from their visit to the Oceanus fish processing plant to their talk with the geneticists at McGill. Austin cut in. "Did you say Frederick Barker?" "Yes," Gamay said. "Do you know him?" "We've had a passing acquaintance. His men tried to kill me last night." Austin gave the gathering a quick rundown of his encounter with Barker and the wild dog sled race through the mall. "Congratulations, Kurt. The traffic tie-up you caused was page one in the Washington Post." Sandecker paused in thought. "Let me see if I understand this story to date. You believe that Oceanus orchestrated the sinking of two ships in Faroe waters to divert attention from a secret project directed by this man, Barker, having to do with the breeding of mutant fish." He gestured at the screen. "Fish similar to the one Paul and Gamay encountered in Canada, and that people from a rogue Eskimo tribe made attempts on your life in the Faroes, in Copenhagen, and in Washington." "Sounds unbelievable when somebody else tells it," Austin said with a shake of his head. "Baron Munchausen couldn't have done better. Luckily, Paul and Gamay have verified the existence of these homicidal Eskimos." He turned to Gunn. "What do you make of this fantastic tale, Rudy?" "Before I answer, I'd like to ask Gamay what would happen if these artificially mutated superfish got into the sea and started breeding." "According to Dr. Throckmorton, Barker's colleague, in sufficient numbers, they could create a biological time bomb," Gamay said. "They could replace the natural strains of fish within a few generations." "What's wrong with that?" Sandecker said, playing devil's advocate. "Fishermen would have to catch a few large fish instead of many smaller ones." "True, but we don't know enough about the long-range effects. What would happen if these frankenfish had some property that made them unfit for human consumption? What if an unforeseen mutant strain resulted? What if the superfish offspring couldn't survive in the wild? You'd have neither the natural species nor the mutants. The ocean system would be thrown out of whack. Fishermen, processing people, and distributors would be idled around the world. This would disrupt whole societies that depend upon fish protein for nourishment. Industrial nations would be damaged as well."
"That's quite a dismal forecast," Sandecker said.
"I'm being conservative in my assessment. There are so many unknowns. We know that more than 25 species are being targeted for genetic modification. It could mean a tragedy of unimaginable proportions if they escape into the sea."
"We're assuming that monster up there escaped from a research lab," Rudy said.
Suppose he and the others like him were released into the sea deliberately. Geme stared at Gunn as if he had grown a set of horns. Why would anyone risk extinction of a whole species? That would be a terrible thing. Gunn shook his head. Not for everyone. What are you saying? Sandecker asked. That the fish will vanish from the sea, but not from the Oceanus holding tanks. Oceanus has been acquiring international patents for its fish genes. The species would be preserved in Oceanus DNA banks. Very clever, Rudy, Sandecker said. Oceanus would have created a monopoly on a major source of the world's protein. Paul said a monopoly like that could be worth billions of dollars. It goes beyond money, Sandecker said. Fish protein is a major source of nourishment for much of the world. Food is power. This explains why Oceanus is so trigger-happy, Austin said. If the news got out that they were about to deplete the world's oceans, the adverse public reaction would be overwhelming. Certainly sounds plausible, Gunn said. You establish biofish hatcheries around the world. You could seed the major fish breeding areas in a short time. You wouldn't need many fish, Geme said. Each male biofish released could breed with dozens of females. But I'd like to point out there is nothing illegal about dumping fish into the open sea. They've been responsible for the loss of 2 ships and several deaths, trying to keep their dirty little secret, Austin said. They're holding an entire Indian village captive. Last I heard, murder and kidnapping were illegal. Sandecker said, but since we can't pin the killings and other crimes on Oceanus yet, we'll have to proceed with care. We can't go through the regular channels. Even the Canadian government can't know of our action. Oceanus could bring the forces of the law down on us. The Special Assignments Team was formed for missions away from official oversight, so it's the perfect vehicle to carry out our plan. I didn't know we had a plan, Zavala said. Seems obvious to me, the Admiral said. We blow Oceanus and their bloody scheme out of the water like the pirates they are. I realize it won't be easy. Nighthawk's family and relatives could be placed in jeopardy. The fact that we've stumbled onto their scene might make Oceanus act in haste. There's another factor we should take into account, Austin said. Marcus Ryan is determined to get SOS involved. They could compromise our plan and put the captives in real danger. That settles it, Sandecker said. We move immediately. We've got to strike at the heart of this thing, that facility in the Canadian woods. Kurt, did this young Indian give you any inkling where his village was located? Ryan had him on a short leash. Ben seems to have disappeared, but I'll keep trying to find him. We can't wait that long. Sandecker's gaze moved over to a scruffy-looking man who had quietly slipped into the room during the discussion and taken a seat on a corner. Hiram, do you have something for us? Hiram Yeager was the director of the vast computer network that covered the entire 10th floor of the Numa building. The center processed and stored the biggest amount of digital data on the oceans ever assembled under one roof. The brains behind this incredible display of information-gathering power was dressed in his standard uniform, Levi pants and jacket over a pure white t-shirt. His feet were stuffed into a pair of cowboy boots that looked as if they had come from Boot Hill. His long hair was tied in a ponytail, and his gray eyes peered out at the world through wire-rimmed granny glasses. Rudy asked me to see if Max would compile a list of places that have experienced sudden fish kills and to cross-check, when possible, with nearby fish processing plants or farms. Do you want us to adjourn this meeting to the data center? Sandecker asked. Yeager's boyish face beamed with excitement. Stay right where you are. You're about to see a demonstration of portable Max. Sandecker grimaced. He was impatient to get his troops moving and wasn't interested in Jaeger's experiments, only their results. But his respect for the computer genius displayed itself in the same uncharacteristic patience that allowed Jaeger to ignore the Numa dress code. Jaeger connected a laptop computer to various outlets and to the video screen. He clicked the on button. Anyone who expected an ordinary presentation didn't know Hiram Jaeger. The image of a woman appeared on the video screen. Her eyes were topaz brown and her hair a shiny auburn. Her shoulders were bare down to the first hints of her breasts. It was hard to believe that the lovely woman on the screen was an artificial intelligence system, the end product of the most complex electronic circuitry imaginable. Jaeger had recorded his voice, digitally altering it to give it a feminine tone, and programmed the face of his wife into the system. Max tended to be just as testy and petulant as the original, a successful artist as she was. When he was working in the data center, Jaeger sat at a huge console and Max was projected in 3D onto a giant monitor. With the portable Max, you don't have to come to the data center to ask questions. The laptop connects to the mainframe so I can bring her with me wherever I go. Isn't that right, Max? Normally, Max responded to the opening question with a dazzling smile, but the face on the screen looked as if she had been sucking on lemons. Jaeger fiddled with the connections and tried again. Max, are you okay? The eyes looked down to the bottom of the screen. I'm feeling rather flat. You look fine from out here, Jaeger said. Fine? No, you look wonderful. Sandecker's patience had run out. Perhaps you should send the young lady a bouquet of roses. That always works for me, Zavala said. Sandecker shot him a withering look. Thank you for giving us the benefit of your wide experience, Joe. I'm sure you can include it in your memoirs. Hiram, could you cut to the chase, please? Max smiled. Hello, Admiral Sandecker. Hello, Max. Hiram is correct when he says you look wonderful. But I think we should end this portable Max experiment. In the future, we will visit you in the data center. Thanks for your understanding, Admiral. What can I do for you? Please produce the data, Hiram requested. The face instantly disappeared. In its place was a map of the world. Max's voice narrated, This map shows the locations where there have been fish kills near aquaculture facilities. I can give you specifics for each location. Don't bother for now. Please show us those aquaculture sites owned by Oceanus. Some of the circles vanished, but a substantial number remained. Now go to Canada, Sandecker said. The picture zoomed in on Cape Breton. Bingo, Paul Trout said. That's where Gamay and I had our run-in with Oceanus. Austin said, Max, could you draw a straight line from the Oceanus site to the nearest lake in northern Canada? The map displayed a line that connected the coastal facility with the interior, but the lake it showed was too small and too close to civilization. After several tries, Max connected the aquaculture operation to the only lake large and remote enough to fit Nighthawk's description. We can run some satellite photos on this site, but my instincts tell me this is the right place, Austin said. Thank you, Max. You can shut down now, Sandecker said. The screen went blank. Sandecker, who was obviously pleased with himself, turned to Zavala and said, Now that's how you handle a woman. His face grew serious. I think it's time to get moving, he said. Zavala raised his hand and cleared his throat. This is pretty rugged country. Assuming we find these hombres with no trouble, do we just drop in on them? Sandecker looked as if the question surprised him. I'm open to suggestions. I've got one. Call in the Royal Canadian Mounties. I'm sure you can do it without their help. Sandecker showed his even teeth in a crocodile smile.
You have carte blanche.
I'd rather have the Mounties, Zavala said. If they're busy, a contingent of special forces might do.
I don't blame Joe for being doubtful, Austin said, coming to his partner's aid. As the Trouts and I know, Oceanus shoots first and asks questions later.
It would take too long to go through the red tape necessary to involve the Canadian military or police.
As for special forces, we would need presidential authority to trespass on Canadian turf. I don't see that coming.
In that case, I'd like to make a proposal, Austin said. He related his conversation with Aguirre's.
Sandecker puffed thoughtfully on his cigar. Let me see. You'd like to use the resources of this Basque, who may or may not be a terrorist, to carry out a Numa mission in a foreign country, Sandecker said. If we can't use the U.S. Marines or the Mounties, he might be all we have.
Sandecker said. Can he be trusted?
He can be trusted to do whatever he can to find his relics. Beyond that, I can't say other than to remind you that he saved my life on two occasions.
Sandecker tugged at his precisely trimmed beard. The idea of using the Basque appealed to the Admiral's unconventional side, but he was reluctant to lose control of the situation. On the other hand, he had complete confidence in Austin and his team.
Use your best judgment, Sandecker said.
There's something else, Austin said. He told them about the overnight closing of the museum exhibition and the accident involving Senator Graham.
But I know Graham well, Sandecker said.
Gunn nodded.
And guess what his Commerce Committee has been involved in lately? Legislation trying to close loopholes that would allow biofish to be shipped into the U.S.
Quite a coincidence, isn't it? Austin said, especially since he was returning from a party hosted by Oceanus.
Are you suggesting, Sandecker said, that this exhibition was an elaborate cover for an assassination crew?
It fits. With Graham out of the way, those loopholes may never be closed.
I agree. There are certainly enough party hacks around to raise the possibility of bribes, said Sandecker, who had a low opinion of Congress.
Austin said, Oceanus has cleared away a major obstacle. I think they're about to make their move.
Sandecker rose from his seat and glanced around the table with his cold blue eyes.
Then it's high time we made ours, he said.
When Austin returned to his office, a message was waiting for him from the captain of the Numa research vessel, William Beebe, working with the Danes in the Faroe Islands.
Call immediately, the message said, and left a phone number.
I thought you'd want to know, the captain said when Austin reached him. There's been an accident out here. A research vessel working with a Danish scientist named Jorgensen blew up somehow. They lost 8 people, including the professor.
Austin had forgotten about Jorgensen's plans to continue his research near the Oceanus plant. Now he recalled warning the professor to be careful.
Thank you, Captain, he said. Any idea what caused the explosion?
The lone survivor said something about a helicopter in the area before the explosion, but she didn't make sense. She was the one who suggested that we call you, in fact. Seems she was on the boat as a guest of the professor. Name was Pia something.
She's a friend of mine. How is she?
A few broken bones, some burns. But the doctors expect that she'll pull through.
Sounds like a tough lady.
She is.
Could you give her a message?
Of course.
Tell her I'll be over to see her as soon as she's feeling better.
Will do.
Austin thanked the captain and hung up. He stared into space, his jaw muscle working, his blue-green eyes at the topaz level on Mohs' scale of hardness.
He was thinking of Jorgensen's horsey smile and Pia's kindness. Barker, or Tanook, or whatever his name was, had made the mistake of his life. By killing the professor and injuring Pia, he had made it personal.